The beast remembers. This time, Vimes slept soundly. He had always found it easier to sleep during the day. 25 years on nights had ground the nocturnal groove in his brain. Darkness was easier somehow. He knew how to stand still, a talent that few possess, and how to merge into the shadows. How to guard, in fact, and see without being seen. He remembered Find the Swing. A lot of it was history. The revolt would have happened with Swing or without him, but he was, as it were, the tip of the boil. He'd been trained at the Assassin's School, and should never have been allowed to join the Watch. He had too much brain to be a copper. At least, too much of the wrong kind of brain. But Swing had impressed Windo with his theories, had been let in as a sergeant, and then promoted to captain immediately. Vimes had never known why. It was probably because the officers were offended at seeing such a fine gentleman pounding the streets with the rest of the oiks. Besides, he had a weak chest or something. Vimes wasn't against intellect. Anyone with enough savvy to let go of a doorknob could be a street monster in the old days, but to make it above sergeant you needed a grab bag of guile, cunning, and street wisdom that could pass for intelligence in a poor light. Swing, though, started in the wrong place. He didn't look around and watch and learn and then say, "This is how people are, how do we deal with it?" No, he sat and thought, "This is how people ought to be, how do we change them?" And that was a good enough thought for a priest, but not for a copper, because Swing's patient, pedantic way of operating had turned policing on its head. There had been that weapons law for a start. Weapons were involved in so many crimes that Swing reasoned reducing the number of weapons had to reduce the crime rate. Vimes wondered if he'd sat up in bed in the middle of the night and hugged himself when he dreamed that one up. Confiscate all weapons and crime would go down. It made sense. It would have worked, too, if only there had been enough coppers, say, 3 per citizen. Amazingly, quite a few weapons were handed in. The flaw, though, was one that had somehow managed to escape Swing, and it was this. Criminals don't obey the law. It's more or less a requirement for the job. They had no particular interest in making the streets safer for anyone except themselves. And they couldn't believe what was happening. It was like Hog's Watch every day. Some citizens took the not unreasonable view that something had gone a bit askew if only naughty people were carrying arms, and they got arrested in large numbers. The average copper, when he's been kicked in the nadgers once too often, and has reason to believe that his bosses don't much care, has an understandable tendency to prefer to arrest those people who won't instantly try to stab him, especially if they act a bit snotty and wear more expensive clothes than he personally can afford. The rate of arrests shot right up, and Swing had been very pleased about that. Admittedly, most of the arrests had been for possessing weaponry after dark, but quite a few had been for assaults on the watch by irate citizens. That was assault on a city official, a very heinous and despicable crime, and as such, far more important than all those thefts that were going on everywhere. It wasn't that the city was lawless. It had plenty of laws. It just didn't offer many opportunities not to break them. Swing didn't seem to have grasped the idea that the system was supposed to take criminals and, in some rough-and-ready fashion, force them into becoming honest men. Instead, he'd taken honest men and turned them into criminals, and the Watch, by and large, into just another gang. And then, just when the whole wretched stew was thickening, he'd invented craniometrics. Bad coppers had always had their ways of finding out if someone was guilty. Back in the old days, now, these included thumbscrews, hammers, small pointed bits of wood, and, of course, the common desk drawer, always a boon to the copper in a hurry. Swing didn't need any of this. He could tell if you were guilty by looking at your eyebrows. He measured people. He used calipers and a steel ruler, and he quietly wrote down the measurements and did some sums, such as dividing the length of the nose by the circumference of the head and multiplying it by the width of the space between the eyes. And on such figures, he could infallibly tell you that you were devious, untrustworthy, and congenitally criminal. After you had spent the next 20 minutes in the company of this staff and their less sophisticated tools of inquiry, he would amazingly be proved right. Everyone was guilty of something. Vimes knew that. Every copper knew it. That was how you maintained your authority. Everyone talking to a copper was secretly afraid you could see their guilty secret written on their forehead. You couldn't, of course. But neither were you supposed to drag someone off the street and smash their fingers with a hammer until he told you what it was. Swing would probably have ended up face down in some alley somewhere if it wasn't for the fact that Winder had found him a useful tool. No one could sniff out conspiracies like Swing, and so he'd ended up running the unmentionables, most of whom made Sergeant Knock look like good copper of the month. Vimes had always wondered how the man had kept control, but maybe it was because the thugs recognized, in some animal way, a mind which had arrived at thuggery by the long route, and was capable of devising, in the name of reason, the kind of atrocities that unreason could only dream of. It wasn't easy living in the past. You couldn't whack someone for what they were going to do, or what the world was going to find out later. You couldn't warn people either. You didn't know what would change the future, but if he understood things right, history tended to spring back into shape. All you could change was the bits around the edges, the fine details. There was nothing he could do about the big stuff. The lilac was still going to bloom. The revolution was going to happen. Well, a kind of revolution. That wasn't really the word for what it was. There was the People's Republic of Treacle Mine Road. Truth, justice, freedom, reasonably priced love, and a hard-boiled egg. That would live for all of a few hours, a strange candle that burned too briefly and died like a firework. And there was the scouring of the House of Pain and the... Anyway, you did the job that was in front of you, like unimaginative coppers always did. He got up around 1 in the afternoon. Lorne was closeted in his surgery, doing something that involved some serious whimpering on the part of something else. Vimes knocked on the door. After a moment, it was opened a fraction. Dr. Lorne was wearing a face mask and holding a very long pair of tweezers in his hand.
Yes?
I'm going out, said Vimes. Trouble?
Not too bad. Slidy Harris was unlucky at cards last night. That's all. Played the Ace of Hearts.
That's an unlucky card.
It is if Big Tony knows he didn't deal it to you. But I'll soon have it removed. If you're going to injure anyone tonight, can you do it before I go to bed? Thank you.
Lorne shut the door. Vimes nodded at the woodwork and went out to stretch his legs and get some lunch. It was waiting for him on a tray around the neck of a man. Quite a young man now, but there was something about the expression, as of a rat who was expecting cheese right around the next corner, and had been expecting cheese around the last corner too, and the corner before that. And, although the world had turned out so far to be full of corners, yet completely innocent of any cheese at all, was nevertheless quite certain that, just around the corner, cheese awaited. Vimes stared. But why should he be surprised? As long ago as he could remember, there was always someone selling highly suspicious chemically reclaimed pork products in this town. The seller was very familiar, just younger. His expression lit up at the sight of an unfamiliar face. The seller liked to meet people who hadn't yet bought one of his pies.
"Ah, Sergeant! Hey, what's the little crown mean?"
"Sergeant-at-arms," said Vimes. "That's like Sergeant with all the trimmings."
"Well, Sergeant, could I interest you in a very special sausage in a bun? Guaranteed no rat. 100% organic. All pork shaved before mixing."
"Why not?" thought Vimes. And his stomach, liver, kidneys, and lengths of intestine all supplied reasons, but he fumbled in his pocket for some change anyway.
"How much, Mr.
Vimes remembered in time, and made a show of looking at the name on the front of the tray.
Dibbler?
4 pence, Sergeant.
And that's cutting your own throat, eh?
Said Vimes jovially.
Pardon?
Said Dibbler, looking puzzled.
I said, a price like that's cutting your own throat, eh?
Cutting my own... throat? Said Vimes desperately.
Oh.
Dibbler thought about this.
Right, yeah, it is. You never said it through a word. So you'll have one, then.
I notice it says on your tray, Dibbler Enterprises Est, said Vimes. Shouldn't it say when you were established?
Should it?
Dibbler looked down at his tray.
How long you been going? Said Vimes, selecting a pie.
Well, let's see, what year is this?
Dancing dog, I think.
Since Tuesday, then, said Dibbler. His face brightened.
But this is only the start, mister. This is just to get a stake together. In a year or two, I'm going to be a big man in this town.
I believe you, said Vimes. I really do.
Dibbler looked down at his tray again as Vimes strolled off.
Cutting my own throat. Cutting my own throat, he mumbled to himself, and seemed to like the sound of it.
But then he focused more clearly on the tray, and his face went pale.
Sergeant, he shouted, don't eat the pie.
Vimes, a few yards away, stopped with the pie halfway to his mouth.
What's wrong with it? He said. Silly me. I mean, what's uniquely wrong with it? Nothing. I mean, these are better.
Vimes risked another look at the tray. They all looked the same to him. Dibbler's pies quite often looked appetizing. Therein lay their one and only charm.
I can't see any difference, he said.
Yeah, there is, said Dibbler, sweat beading on his forehead. See, the one you got has got a little pattern of pastry pigs on it, and all the others have pastry sausages.
I'd hate to think that, you know, I thought you were a pig or anything. So if you'll hand it over, I'll happily give you another one. That one's not the right one. Not that it's the wrong one, but with the pig and everything.
Vimes looked into the man's eyes. Dibbler had yet to learn that friendly blankness that 30 years of selling truly organic pies would call into being. While the man stared in horror, he took a large bite out of the pie. It was everything that he had expected, and nothing that he could identify.
Yum, he said, and, with some concentration, eyes fixed on the luckless pieman, finished it all.
I think it's quite possible no one else makes pies like you do, Mr. Dibbler, he said, licking his fingers in case he might want to shake hands with someone later on.
You ate it all, said Dibbler. Was that wrong? Said Vimes.
And now relief rose off the man like smoke off a greenwood fire.
What? No, that's fine. Jolly good. Want another one to help it down? Half price.
No, one is more than enough, said Vimes, backing away.
You finished every bit, said Dibbler.
That was right, wasn't it? Said Vimes.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, obviously.
Got to be going, said Vimes, moving on down the lane.
I'll look forward to seeing you again when I've got less appetite.
He waited until he was well out of sight before taking a few random turns in the network of alleys. Then he stepped into the shadow of a deep doorway and felt in his mouth for the piece of pie that had seemed curiously unchewable even by pie standards. Usually, if you found something more than usually hard or crunchy in one of Dibbler's famous pork pies, the trick was to either swallow it and hope for the best, or spit it out with your eyes closed. But Vimes felt around between gum and cheek and fished out a folded piece of paper, stained with unknowable juices. He unfolded it. In smudged pencil, but still decipherable, it read, Morphic Street, 9 o'clock tonight, password Swordfish.
Swordfish. Every password was Swordfish. Whenever anyone tried to think of a word that no one would ever guess, they always chose Swordfish.
It was just one of those strange quirks of the human mind. That explained the guilt, anyway. A plot. Another damn plot in a city full of plots. Did he need to know about plots? Anyway, he knew about this one, Morphic Street. The famous Morphic Street conspiracy. He pushed the greasy scrap into a pocket and then hesitated. Someone was being quiet. Overlaid on the distant street noises was a sort of hollow in the sounds, filled by careful breathing, and the hairs on the back of his neck were standing up. Quietly, he pulled the blackjack out of his rear pocket. Now, what were the options? He was a copper, and someone was creeping up on him. If they weren't a copper, then they were in the wrong, because he was a copper. If they were a copper too, then they were one of Swing's crew, and therefore in the wrong, because he was a better copper than them, and so were things floating in gutters. And therefore, delivering a swift bucketful of darkness had no obvious downside. On the other hand, thieves, assassins, and Swing's men, by all accounts, did a lot of creeping up on people and were probably pretty good at it, whereas the person tracking him was keeping their back so close to the wall he could hear the scraping. That meant they were probably just a member of the public, with something on their mind, and he was not inclined to add several ounces of lead shot simply for that reason, because he'd like to believe he wasn't that sort of copper. He settled for stepping out into the alley and saying, Yeah?
A boy stared up at him. It had to be a boy. Nature would not have been so cruel as to do that to a girl. No single feature in itself was more than passably ugly, but the combination was greater than the sum of the parts. There was also the smell. It wasn't bad as such. It just wasn't entirely human. There was something feral about it.
"Eh," said its pinched-up face. "Look, tell you what, mister. You tell me where you're going, and I'll stop following you. Have we got a deal? Costs you no more than a penny, and that's a special price. Some people will pay me a lot more than that to stop following them."
Vimes continued to stare. The creature was wearing an oversized evening dress jacket, shiny with grease and greenish with age, and a top hat that must once have been trodden on by a horse. But the bits that were visible between the two were regrettably familiar. "Oh, no," he moaned. "No, no, no."
"You're right, mister."
"No, no, no. Oh, ye gods, it had to happen, didn't it?"
"You want us to go and fetch Mossy, mister?"
Vimes pointed an accusing finger.
"You're Nobby Nobs, right?"
The urchin backed away.
"Might be. So what? Is that a crime?"
He turned to run, but Vimes's hand fell heavily on the shoulder.
"Some people might say so. You're Nobby Nobs, son of Maisie Nobs and Sconner Nobs." "Probably, probably. But I ain't done nothing, mister."
Vimes bent down to look into eyes that peered out at the world through a mask of grime.
"How about whizzing wipers, snitching tinklers, pulling wobblers, flogging tumblers, and running rumbles?"
Nobby's brow creased in genuine puzzlement.
"What's pulling wobblers mean?" he said.
Vimes gave him a similar look. Street parley had changed a lot in 30 years.
"That's stealing trifles, small items, isn't it?" "No, no, no, mister, that's tottering Neville's," said Nobby, relaxing. "But you ain't doing badly for someone who's new. What's Oil of Angels?"
Memory flicked a card.
"A bribe," said Vimes. "And a dimber?" said Nobby, grinning. "Easy. Could be a head beggar, could be just a handsome man." "Well done. Bet you don't know how to fleeg a jade, though."
Once again, from a dusty recess, a memory unrolled. This one stuck in your mind.
"Dear me, do you know what? What a shame in one so young," said Vimes. "That's when you want to sell a broken-down horse and have to make it a bit frisky in front of the punters, and so you take some fresh, raw, hot ginger, lift up its tail, and push the ginger."
"Caw,"
said Nobby, suddenly impressed.
"Everyone says you're a real quick learner, and that's true enough. You could have been born here."
"Why are you following me, Nobby Nobs?" said Vimes.
The urchin held out a grubby hand. Some street language never changes. Vimes pulled out sixpence. It shone in Nobby's palm like a diamond in a chimney sweep's ear.
"One of 'em's a lady,"
he said, and grinned. The hand stayed out.
"That was a bloody sixpence I just gave you, kid,"
Vimes growled.
"Yeah, but I got to think of—"
Vimes grabbed the lapels of Nobby's greasy coat and lifted him up, and was mildly shocked to realize that there was practically no weight there. "Street urchin," he thought. "Urchin sounds about right, spiky, slimy, and smelling slightly of rotting seaweed. But there's hundreds of them round here, clawing a living off the very margins, and as I recall, Nobby was one of the sharpest, and as trustworthy as a chocolate hammer. But that's okay. There's ways to deal with that."
"How much," he said, "for you to work for me all the time?" "I got customers to think of," he began.
"Yeah, but I'm the one holding you up in one hand, right?" said Vimes.
With his oversized boots dangling a foot above the ground, Nobby considered his position.
"All the time?"
"Right."
For something like that, I've got to be looking at a lordship every day."
"A dollar, guess again."
Half a dollar?"
"Not a chance. A dollar a week, and I won't make your life the utter misery which, Nobby, I assure you, I can do in so many little ways."
Still dangling, Nobby tried to work all this out.
"So, I'll be, kind of like a copper, right?"
he said, grinning artfully.
"Kind of."
"Number one suspect says it's a good life being a copper, because you can pinch stuff without getting nicked."
"He's got that right," said Vimes.
"And he says if anyone gives you lip, you can bop 'em one and chuck 'em in the tanty,"
Nobby went on.
"I'd like to be a copper one day."
"Who's number one suspect?"
"That's what our man calls Sconner, our dad. Payment up front, yeah?"
Nobby added hopefully.
What do you think?
Ah, right. Now, eh?
Correct.
But I'll tell you what. He lowered Nobby to the ground. Light as a feather, he thought. You come with me, kid. Ankh Morpork was full of men living in lodgings. Anyone with a spare room rented it out. And, in addition to the darning and stitching that was turning Miss Batty into one of the highest-earning seamstresses in the city, they needed something else that women were best able to supply. They needed feeding. There were plenty of hot-chair eating places like the one Vimes headed for now. It sold plain food for plain men. There wasn't a menu. You ate what was put in front of you. You ate it quick, and you were glad to get it. If you didn't like it, there were plenty who did. The dishes had names like Slum Gullet, Boiled Eels, Lobscouse, Wet Nellies, Slumpy, and Treacle Billy. Good, solid stuff that stuck to the ribs and made it hard to get up out of the seat. They generally had a lot of turnip in, even if they weren't supposed to. Vimes elbowed his way to the counter, dragging Nobby behind him. A chalked sign said, "All you can eat in 10 minutes for 10p." Beneath it, a large woman was standing bare-armed by a cauldron in which uncertain things bubbled in grey scum. She gave him an appraising look and then glanced at his sleeve.
"What can I do for you, Sergeant?" she said. "What happened to Sergeant Nook?"
"Comes in here a lot, does he?" said Vimes.
"Dinner and supper?"
Her look said it all. Second helpings, too, and never pays. Vimes held up Nobby. "See this?"
"Is it a monkey?"
said the woman.
"Ha, ha, very funny!"
moaned Nobby as Vimes lowered him again. "He's going to come in here for one square meal every day," said Vimes. "All he can eat for 10p.
"Yes? And who's paying, may I ask?"
"Me." Vimes plonked a half dollar on the table. "That's 5 days in advance. What's the special today? Slum Gullet? It'll put airs in his chest when he has his chest. Give him a big bowl. You might make a loss on this deal." He shoved Nobby onto a bench, placed the greasy bowl in front of him and sat down opposite. "You said a lady," he said. "Don't mess me about, Nobby."
"Have I got to share this, Sarge?"
said Nobby, picking up a wooden spoon.
"It's all yours. Make sure you eat up every bit. There may be a test later," said Vimes. "A woman, you said?"
"Lady Meserol, Sarge,"
said Nobby indistinctly, through a mouthful of mixed vegetables and grease.
"Posh lady. Everyone calls her madam. Come from Genoa a few months ago."
"When did she ask you?"
"This morning, Sarge."
"What? She just stopped you in the street?"
I've got a kind of general contract with her, Sarge."
Vimes glared. It was better than speaking. Nobby wriggled uneasily.
"Fact is, Sarge, she, caught me snickering her lolly last month. Hell's bells, Sarge. She's got a punch on her like a mule. When I come round, we got to talking, and she said a keen young lad like me could be useful as like, an ear on the street."
Vimes continued to glare, but he was impressed. Young Nobby had been a gifted pickpocket. Anyone who caught him in the act was quick indeed. He turned up the ferocity of the glare.
"All right, Sarge. She said she'd turn me over to the day watch if I didn't,"
Nobby confessed.
"And you go straight to the tanty if a knob lays a complaint against you."
"That's bloody true," thought Vimes. "Private law again."
"I don't want to go to the tanty, Sarge. Sconner's in there."
"And he used to break your arms," Vimes remembered.
"So why's a fine lady interested in me, Nobby?" he said aloud.
"Didn't ask. I told her about you and the hurry-up wagon and the unmentionables and everything. She said you sounded fascinating. And Rosie Palms pay me a measly penny a day to keep an eye on you, too. Oh, and Corporal Snubs at Cable Street, he's paying me 1/2p to watch you. But what's 1/2p these days, says I, so I don't watch you much on his account. Oh, and Lance Corporal Coates, I'm getting a penny from him, too."
"Why?"
"Dunno. He asked me this morning, too. A penny job."
Nobby belched hugely.
"Better out than in, eh? Who do you want me to watch for you, Sarge?"
"Me," said Vimes. "If you can fit me into your busy schedule."
"You want me to follow you?"
"No. Just tell me what people are saying about me. Keep an eye on who else is following me. Watch my back sort of thing."
"Right."
"Good.
Just one more thing, Nobby."
"Yes, Sarge?"
said Nobby, still spooning.
"Give me back my notebook, my handkerchief, and the 4p you whizzed from my pockets, will you?"
Nobby opened his mouth to protest, dribbling Slum Gullet, but closed it when he saw the glint in Vimes' eye. Silently, he produced the items from the various horrible pockets.
"Well done," said
said Vimes, getting up. "I'm sure I don't have to tell you what happened to you if you try the old dippity-doo-dah on me again, do I, Nobby?"
"No, Sarge," said Nobby, looking down.
"Want another bowl? Have fun. I've got to go to work."
"You can rely on me, Sarge."
Oddly enough, thought Vimes as he walked back to the watch-house, "I probably can." Nobby would nick anything and dodge anything, but he wasn't bad. You could trust him with your life, although you'd be daft to trust him with a dollar. He purchased a packet of Pantweed Slim Panatellas from another street trader. Carrying them around in their cardboard packet didn't feel right at all. There was a buzz in the main office as he strolled in. Watchmen were standing around in little groups. Sergeant Knock spotted Vimes and trotted over.
"You ever do, sir? Had a break-in last night," he reported, with just a hint of a smirk.
"Really?" said Vimes. "What did they steal?"
"Did I say they stole anything, sir?" said the sergeant innocently.
"Well, no, you didn't," said Vimes. "That was me jumping to what we call a conclusion. Did they steal anything then, or did they break in to deliver a box of chocolates and a small complimentary basket of fruit?"
"They stole the captain's silver inkstand," said Knock, impervious to sarcasm. "And it was an inside job, if you want my opinion. The door upstairs was forced, but the main doors weren't. Must have been a couple what done it."
Vimes was amazed at the forensic expertise shown here.
"My word, a copper stealing," he said. "Yeah, it's a terrible thing," said Knock earnestly, "especially since you showed us the way yesterday about being honest and everything."
He glanced past Vimes and shouted,
"Attention, officer present."
Tilden was coming down the stairs. The room fell silent except for his hesitant steps.
No luck, Sergeant," he said.
"Not so far, sir," said Knock. "I was just telling Sergeant Keel here what a terrible thing has happened."
"It was engraved, you know," said Tilden mournfully. "Everyone in the regiment chipped in what they could afford. This is really very upsetting."
"A man would have to be a right bastard to steal something like that, eh, Sergeant?" said Knock.
"Absolutely," said Vimes.
"I see you're pretty well organised on this one, Sergeant. Have you looked everywhere?"
"Everywhere except the lockers," said Knock. "That's not something we do lightly, rummaging through a man's locker. But we're all here now, and Captain Tilden's here to see fair play. So although it's very distasteful, I'll ask you, Captain, for permission to rummage."
"Yes, yes, if you must," said Tilden. "I don't like the idea. It is really quite dishonourable, you know."
"Then I think, sir, to show that we're doing this fairly," said Knock, "us sergeants ought to be searched first. That way, no one can say we don't take it seriously."
"Come now, Sergeant," said Tilden with a little smile. "I hardly think you're suspected."
"No, sir, fair's fair," said Knock. "We'll set a good example, eh, Sergeant Keel?"
Vimes shrugged. Knock grinned at him, pulled out a bundle of keys, and beckoned to Lance Corporal Coates.
"You do the honours, Ned," he said, beaming. "Me first, of course."
The door was unlocked. The contents of Knock's locker were the usual unsavoury mess of lockers everywhere, but there was certainly no silver inkstand. If there were, it would have turned black after a single day.
"Well done. Now, Sergeant Keels, please, Ned."
Knock's friendly beam fixed on Vimes as the policeman fumbled with the lock. Vimes stared back, face blank as a slate, as the door creaked open.
"Oh, dear, what have we here?"
said Knock, without even bothering to look.
"It's a sack, Sarge," said Coates. "Something heavy in it, too."
"Oh, dear me," said Knock, still staring at Vimes. "Open it up, lad, gently. We don't want anything to get damaged, eh?"
There was a rustle of hessian, and then...
"It's half a brick," Ned reported.
"What?"
"Half brick, sir."
"I'm saving up for a house," said Vimes. There were one or two sniggers from the assembled men, but some of the faster thinkers were suddenly looking worried. "They know," thought Vimes. "Well, lads, welcome to Vimes's roulette. You spun the wheel, and now you've got to guess where the ball is going to go."
"Are you sure?"
said Knock, turning to the open locker.
"It's just a sack, Sarge," said Ned, "and half brick."
"Is there a loose panel or something?" said Knock desperately.
"What? In a sack, Sarge?"
"Well, that seems to be our lockers," said Vimes, rubbing his hands together. "Who's next, Sergeant Knock?"
"Round and round the little ball goes, and where it stops.
perhaps. Nobody knows.
You know, personally, I think the captain's right. I don't think any of the men would... Nock began and faltered. Vimes's stare could have hammered rivets.
I believe, Sergeant, that since we have begun this, it should be concluded, said Tilden. That's only fair.
Vimes took a couple of steps towards Coates and held out his hand.
Keys, he said.
Coates glared at him.
The keys, Lance Corporal, said Vimes.
He snatched them from Coates's hand and turned to the line of lockers.
Right, he said. Let's start with the well-known arch-criminal, Lance Constable Vimes.
Door after door was opened. The lockers, while possibly of interest to anyone studying the smells of unwashed clothing and the things that could grow on neglected socks, failed to produce a single silver inkstand. It did turn up the amorous adventures of Molly Clapper in Corporal Colon's locker, however. Vimes stared at the crude and grubby engravings like a long-lost friend. He remembered that book. It had gone round the watch-house for years, and as a young man he learned a lot from some of those illustrations, although a good deal of what he'd learned had turned out to be wrong. Fortunately, Captain Tilden's view was blocked, and Vimes shoved the greasy book back on the shelf and said to the red-eared Colon,
"Studying theory, eh, Fred? Good man. Practice makes perfect."
Then he turned at last to Coates's locker. The man was watching him like a hawk. The scratched door creaked open. Every neck craned to see. There was a stack of old notebooks, some civilian clothing, and a small sack of what, when it was tipped out on the floor, turned out to be laundry.
"Surprised," said the Lance Corporal.
"Not half as much as you," Vimes thought. He winked at Coates and turned away.
"Can I have a word with you in your office, Captain?"
Yes, Sergeant, I suppose so," said Tilden, looking round. "Oh, dear."
Vimes gave the man some time to climb the stairs, then followed him up to his office and tactfully closed the door.
"Well, Sergeant," said Tilden, collapsing into his chair.
"Have you looked everywhere, sir?" said Vimes.
"Of course, man."
"I mean, sir, perhaps you put it in a desk drawer. Or the safe, perhaps."
"Certainly not. I sometimes put it in the safe at weekends, but I'm sure I didn't do that last night."
Vimes noted the subtle uncertainty. He was doing a bad thing, he knew. Tilden was nearly 70. At a time like that, a man learned to treat his memory as only a rough guide to events.
"I find, sir, that when a busy man has got a lot on his plate, he can do things that subsequently slip his mind," he said.
"I know I do," he added to himself. "I could put my house keys down in a bare room and not find them 30 seconds later."
"We've all been under a lot of pressure lately," he added,
knowing that Tilden frequently fell asleep during the afternoon until Snouty coughed very loudly outside his door before taking in his cocoa.
"Well, that's true," said Tilden, turning desperate eyes to him. "All this curfew business, very unsettling. Forget my own head if it wasn't nailed on, what?"
He turned and looked at the green safe.
"Only had it a couple of months," he muttered. "I suppose I... Look the other way, will you, Sergeant? May as well sort this out."
Vimes obligingly turned his back. There was some clicking and a creak, and then an intake of breath. Tilden got to his feet, holding the silver inkstand.
"I believe I've made a fool of myself, Sergeant," he said.
"No, I've made a fool of you," thought Vimes, fervently wishing he hadn't. "I'd intended to drop it into Coates's locker, but I couldn't. Not after what I found in there."
"Tell you what, sir," he volunteered. "We could say it was a kind of test." "I don't tell lies, as a rule, Keel," said the captain, but added, "I appreciate the suggestion, nevertheless. Anyway, I know I'm not as young as I was. Perhaps it's time to retire," he sighed. "I have to say I've been considering it for some time."
"Oh, don't talk like that, sir," said Vimes, far more jovially than he felt. "I can't see you retiring."
"Yes, I suppose I should see things through,"
Tilden mumbled, walking back to his desk.
"Do you know, Sergeant, that some of the men think you're a spy?"
"Who for?" said Vimes, reflecting that Snouty delivered more than cocoa.
"A Lord Winder, I assume," said Tilden.
"Well, we all work for him, sir, but I don't report to anyone but you, if that's any help."
Tilden looked up at him and shook his head sadly.
"Spy or not, Keel, I don't mind telling you that some of the orders we've been getting lately have not been thought out properly, in my opinion, what?"
He gave Vimes a glare, as if defying him to produce the red-hot thumbscrews there and then. Vimes could see how much the admission that abduction and torture and conspiracy to criminalise honest citizens might not be acceptable government policy was costing the old man. Tilden hadn't been brought up to think like that. He'd ridden off under the flag of Ankh-Morpork to fight the cheese-eaters of Quirm or Johnny Clatchian or whatever enemies had been selected by those higher up the chain of command, with never a second thought about the rightness of the cause, because that sort of thinking could slow a soldier down. Tilden had grown up knowing that people at the top were right. That was why they were at the top. He didn't have the mental vocabulary to think like a traitor, because only traitors thought like that.
"I haven't been here long enough to comment, sir," said Vimes. "Don't know how you do things here."
"Not like we used to," mumbled Tilden.
"Just as you say, sir." "Snouty says you know your way around remarkably well, Sergeant, for someone new to the city."
That was a sentence with a hook in the end, but Tilden was an inexperienced angler.
"One nick is pretty much like any other, sir," said Vimes. "And, of course, I've visited the city before."
Of course, said Tilden hurriedly.
"Well, thank you, Sergeant. If you could explain things to the men, I'd be grateful."
"Yes, sir, of course." Vimes shut the door carefully behind him and went down the steps two at a time. The squad below had barely moved. He clapped his hands like a schoolteacher.
Come on, you've got patrols to go to. Get moving. Not you, Sergeant Knock, a word in the yard, please."
Vimes didn't bother to wait to see if the man would follow him. He went out in the late afternoon sunshine, leaned against the wall and waited. 10 years ago, he'd have... Correction. 10 years ago, if he was sober, he'd have taught Knock a few lessons about who's boss with several well-aimed punches. And that was certainly the custom these days. Scraps between watchmen hadn't been uncommon when Vimes was a constable, but that wouldn't do for Sergeant Keel. Knock stepped out, inflated with mad, terrified bravado. When Vimes raised his hand, the man actually flinched.
"Cigar," said Vimes.
"I don't drink," said Vimes, "but you can't beat a good cigar."
I don't smoke," mumbled Doc. "Look, about the inkstand.
Do you know?"
"He'd gone and put it in that safe of his," said Vimes, smiling.
"He had."
"And then forgotten about it," said Vimes. "Happens to us all, Winsborough. A man's mind starts to wander. He's never quite certain of what he's done."
Vimes maintained the friendly grin. It was as good as raining blows. Besides, he'd given Knock his correct name. The man never used it in public for fear of the panic it might cause.
"Just thought I'd put your mind at rest about it," said Vimes.